kind of update to it, because people write these kind of compendium. This is kind of like a compendium or pulling together of, you know, major research. And the good thing about Argyle, and maybe you can start your notes here, is that Argyle brings together the first generation of happiness research. And that generation of research goes back into the 80s maybe, but it's really mostly something that happened in the 90s and early 2000s. But there's been a lot more since then. So I've been frustrated because I haven't found somebody who... It's easy to find more recent research on happiness, but it's not easy to find a real sweet article that pulls a lot together on different topics like this. So, I was getting ready to put together our first writing exercise where you try to sort of write about happiness a little bit. And we do need to do that. We're kind of, I think we're at a point in the semester where you guys are ready to start trying to express yourself about some issues on happiness. You know, we've got a few weeks of work in. But I thought before we got to that assignment, we'd try to sneak in a slightly different novel assignment. Do you have a question?
Oh, sorry, I was just
okay. You're just stretching. Okay. So what I'd like you guys to do, and this is going to be an optional assignment, I'll explain it to you now, and then we'll have our discussion of Argyle, and then that might raise some other questions about the assignment. What I'd like you guys to consider between now and Sunday night is an optional assignment in which you retrieve research, correlational research on happiness, on some of the topics that Argyle reports on, but possibly on other topics. And you post this to the wiki. And this is a way of updating Argyle. So we have the Argyle Update Project, which is a new thing for us. And what you're going to do is this is going to require you to log into the wiki. So I'm going to just briefly explain that, because we talked about it at the beginning of the term, but we didn't really pursue it since then. So real quick, make some notes on how to log into the wiki the first time. The first time you log into the wiki, if you haven't had me as a professor, that is, if you haven't already done this with the wiki, you need to click, this isn't obvious, you need to click on Join Alfino. Sounds like fun anyway. And then you find out that Alfino is made by people like you, which is good. Over 20,000 edits. Oh my God, 600 pages. I haven't seen that recently. So the first time you do Join Alfino and you put in your GU network information, make a note of that. And that's, it's like registering. And then it looks and sees that you're somebody that we trust. And then now after that, you just register by logging in, which would just be, again, your GU network login information, username, password. Okay, and once you do that, you can tell you succeeded because you see these little edit tabs. There's one there, and then each section of the page actually gets an edit tab. So then you would go to the Argyle project, and here's how you do the assignment. You do some research in which you find updated research on some of these topics. Wow, did somebody post already? Look at that. The other class, boy, they're really eager. Look at that. So here we have an example. So you go to the page, and you click on the edit tab up here, and then you just kind of block copy this, and then you paste it down below. Or you actually, like, say you find something on marriage, then you would paste it in here, right? Say you find something on a topic that Argyle didn't talk about, then you would paste it down below. So what you're going to do is you're going to give me the topic, marriage and happiness, income and happiness, social status, summary of findings, one to two sentences, which say what the research found. Could be from the research, from the article abstract. You don't have to write it yourself, but you know, you might want to put it in your own words. A link to the article, ideally, to a website, and then your name. And so what you can do with this assignment between now and Sunday night is you can earn up to 12 points on your Q&W. But, and so I need to explain this part, because what does it mean to say this is optional, right? Okay. So your Q&W points your Q&W grade is going to be points out of total possible. And then that's going to be a percentage. And then, as I told you at the beginning of the term, we're going to curve that. We're going to try and curve it, you know, in a, between like A and B minus. So we're going to try and make it a very relatively friendly curve so you get some information about your performance, but, you know, we don't need to make it a brutal experience. So when you curve the percentages, Well, so let me put it this way. If you don't do this assignment, I won't add 12 points to your total. It'll be just like an excused quiz. Okay? So if you're busy this weekend, and we have 52 happiness students, we don't need absolutely every one of them posting research. But it'd be great if you all did. But if you don't do it, that 12 points won't be added to your total. So the percentage that you have on Q&W won't change. But I do need to point out that since we are curving, it could be that your position in the curve might move a little bit if you don't do it. See what I mean? So in a curved environment, things can be optional, but not completely optional. Ironically, if you guys know your numbers, you know that if the people with the highest current scores are the only people who do the assignment, then you won't lose position at all by not doing it, right? Because they'll just kind of stay in their same position. So anyway, I think it's worth doing, especially if you had a couple of bad quizzes or you just want to improve your QW score. It's not a hard thing to do, and it really will benefit the class and benefit us going forward, because we'll have more updated research on Argyle. So if it appeals to you, use Gonzaga's Foley databases, use Google searches. We're looking for research articles, not just not just an opinion piece, for example. Okay, questions about that assignment? Completely optional. It really won't disadvantage you much if you're too busy to do it. But you might find it kind of interesting. And I'm hoping as we go through Argyle to kind of pique your interest on a couple of the topics that he reports on, and maybe see if that interests you. Any thoughts on that? Are we good? Yeah.
How is it graded out of the 12?
Oh, right. So let's say you put up... So you have a total of... I should have been more clear about this. Three good posts will get you 12 points. And if you don't, it's all or nothing. So if let's say two of them were good, I'll give you 8 points and you wouldn't be penalized for not doing the other four. You see what I mean? You'll get 8 out of 8, right. So this will either be 4 out of 4, 8 out of 8, or 12 out of 12. So it's a good way, it's a good way to improve your... Okay, good. Okay, and questions might come up as we get into the class about it. So let's get to Argyle. Some notes before we get going. There's three things I thought to tell you to look out for in Argyle, and he mentions them as he goes, but I'll just pull them out now so that we can talk, see them as we get to it. The first thing is cluster effects. So when you... when you do correlational research and you pick out a particular factor like income, and you want to know what its correlation, what's the strength of correlation is to happiness, you just because you think you're looking at one thing, it doesn't mean you actually are, right? Income is connected to other goods, right? So a cluster effect, to put it in your notes, is the way that one factor can implicate multiple factors. And the slogan is you're rarely looking at one thing. You can think you're looking at one thing, like income, but income isn't just one thing, right? So income has a cluster effect because, let's get to that as an example. So for example, right, income has a cluster effect. Ethnicity has a cluster effect. Democracy has a cluster effect. Income has a cluster effect because you can buy different kinds of goods with income. You can't. It's not just food and consumable stuff. You can use your income to buy social status. The McCarthy Center, right? That's pretty cool. I hope he gets a big thrill out of that. I mean, we are very nice to people here who have money to support Gonzaga's projects by naming opportunities. We call them naming opportunities. You have your you too. Don't give up. You're smiling, but don't give up the possibility. I mean, you're just graduating soon, but you might come back and you might be able to name a building after you.
Wouldn't also how the income is acquired be a cluster?
Could be, absolutely. That could be a cluster effect, because you could get more satisfaction from acquiring income. Are you thinking of an example?
Well, you have a farmer with thousands and thousands of acres, and you have a stockbroker, or you have someone who just happens to be a venture capitalist.
Right.
They all probably make about the same income, but they
good.
Ask them in different ways.
Yeah, and those they can make those incomes in ways that are or aren't tied to other things that are happiness makers. So if you make your income in a highly sociable activity, you get the benefits. Notice this is what cluster effects are. You get the benefits of whatever power social relationships might have to boost your happiness, right? So the point is that the point to remember is you're rarely actually looking at one thing when you pull out one thing to measure. You're often looking at all the things that thing is connected to. And so sometimes you can control for that. And some of you know statistics. You know that you can sometimes get, I'm getting some nods. How do you control for factors? This came up in the last class. Do you have a sense intuitively how to explain how you control for factors? So let's say, anybody want to try it? Give it a shot.
Well, if you're doing a social experiment with, testing medicine or something, and to avoid the placebo effect, you could do a double-blind experiment.
Right. Good. That would be a way of controlling for a polluting factor, like a factor that's going to distort, right? You could also, anybody have other ideas about how you would say it?
Yeah. Like subsets of the sample size?
Right. So you can, if you have independent data about, say, how philanthropists are made happy by the use of their income, you might be able to factor that out, right? So you might be able to, controlling for a factor often means using independent information you have about that factor to isolate it and remove it from the effect. Depending on the kind of cluster effect, you may or may not be able to do that. That may be hard to do. Okay. We'll see that with income, actually, because... So democracy is a cluster effect because, democracies tend to be found in wealthy places. Democracies tend to include lots of things like political rights, but also, so it's not just the voting that might make you happy. It might be also that you have due process and political rights. You're in a wealthier place if you're living in a democracy. So that's another example for your notes of a cluster effect. Direction of causation is an issue in happiness studies because we often want to know whether the thing we're looking at made people happy, or is it that happy people find themselves around the thing that you're looking at? So does marriage make people happy, or do happy people get married? That would be an example. Does being an extrovert make you happy? Or are happy? Do happy? Let's see. Being an extrovert makes you happy, or do happy people tend to be extroverts? Yeah, well, that's really important. The direction of the causation. So remember, you remember this from other studies you've done. Correlation does not mean causation, right? Remember our picture of the scientific enterprise here, where you have reality giving us data through very controlled observations, and you have your theory. This is my theory of happiness here that you're working on. And you've got predictions that come out of that theory. So correlation just involves this connection in the picture, right? Is there a strong correlation between some factor and happiness? Would you predict that people with that factor are happier? But remember, what we do when we build theories is we don't just find correlations. We also take, when we find strong correlations, we use them to suggest mechanisms, right? So you'll notice in the Argyle article, one of the reasons I've been so stuck on it, it's kind of good in what it does, is he'll present the data and then he'll start a paragraph, well, so what's the explanation, right? So that's the mechanism. So one of the things we want to do in going through the article is I want you to it's a kind of theoretical imagination. You get a result and you try to imagine how it could suggest a mechanism. And one of the ways we do that is by connecting it to other constructs that we have. So we'll get into that later in the course, but we'll be able to play around with that a little bit with Argyle right now. Okay, so that also takes care of correlation and mechanism. We can be impressed by a correlation, but we should use it to prompt a kind of theoretical imagination, which asks, what structures might this correlation point to? What mechanical structures might this point to? Questions about that? It's a little bit of a framework for what we're doing. Okay. All right, let's go through the Argyle reading, and please, I don't find an opportunity here for small group discussion, although I do think there's a couple that come close. I'd like to get your opinion about each of these, and feel free to chime in with questions and puzzles about it. So, let's just start. Ready? Take a couple of notes on each of these factors just in case it helps. And you have these notes available to you, too. So happy researchers were puzzled initially when they found that older people are slightly happier. Because intuitively, it seems like it's hard to be happy as you get really old. Your body's falling apart. You don't have much of a future to look forward to. So to the extent that happiness is about prospects, well, you know, prospects are kind of diminishing as you get older. But there are some, but there is this robust data on older people being slightly happier. By the way, you might find research which contradicts this, right, if you do the exercise. That'd be great to find out. But for the most part, I have seen confirming studies on this. And one theory for your notes is that older people have lower expectations. They've adjusted to their diminished prospects. Please.
Does that mean, like, just because you're older than me, you're happier than me, or people specifically in, like, the retired generation or older?
If you say, on average, how old are 20 to 25-year-olds? On average, how old are, I'm 58, how old are 55 to 60-year-olds? Yeah. Yeah, I've got a little bit of an advantage.
You're 58?
Yeah, what?
I just surprised.
What seem like I should be? Oh, you know, I used to have students predict my age, and they always predicted that I was older than I was, and I stopped doing that. So, I mean, that's not good. So, really, that's funny. I have a sense that I look older than I am, so that's interesting. Okay, that's what it means. But notice, it's not clear, this is a point for your notes, it's not clear that you can compare happiness in the 20s with happiness in older age. There's a way of looking at this that says that that those are such different circumstances that even if my demographic comes up with 0.5 higher on the 1 to 7 scale, it's not clear what that means. My group's happiness problem might be so different from your group's happiness problem, right? Think about the things you guys are facing in the next couple of years. It's very different from the things I'm looking good questions. Yeah, keep interrogating this. So a more optimistic theory is that older people have figured something out, right? One of the interesting results is that older people have consistently lower negative affect. So you could either say, and again, this is about speculating about mechanism, do we have lower negative affect because we just don't give a damn about anything anymore? It's all going to hell. Or do we have lower negative affect because we've actually acquired capacities? Maybe we've actually, you know, maybe on average, older people have actually acquired some skills and capacities for dealing with crap, you know? And they just, so we just, you know, it's not as big a deal anymore. We don't fall apart. So the puzzle was that it's hard to imagine how old people could be happy given just how bad things are with neural degeneration, physical degeneration. An 85-year-old has up to a half an inch of empty space in the top of his cranium because the brain is shrinking. That's great. Don't get me started on decrepitude in old age. The data is absolutely horrifying. You know, just appreciate that you're a long way from it. Okay, so that's kind of age. So notice how we've got data, and then we speculate about a mechanism, and you may find additional research which helps support a particular speculation. Like, say you find research that says that some older people really seem to have these skills of managing negative affect. That would confirm the more optimistic hypothesis. Okay. Feel free to interrupt. There's a lot here, but we can go through it fairly efficiently. Education's one where you might have thought it would have a bigger It's a pretty weak effect, and a lot of the effect comes from income and job status. So again, a cluster effect, right? But even after control for income and job status, there's a little bit of an effect from education. Now again, I need your help in speculating about some of the mechanisms. Assuming you can control for income and job status, what is it about your education that might make you a little bit happier? It could be, remember, we've ruled out job status, so, you know, you get a big pat on the back for graduating college. It could be that you've acquired some skills that allow you to take pleasure in things that you couldn't take pleasure in before. you know, a good book of new research about the brain is just fantastic. It's a good way to curl up on a Friday night and enjoy your evening. Really, seriously, my students who've stayed in touch with me often report that after college, they feel a great liberation to pursue intellectual interests that they never had time for. That could be something as simple as buying a book every few months and having the capacity now that you've studied a bunch of things to enjoy things, to have a kind of pleasure that you couldn't have before. Or what's another possibility? It could be just personal achievement. You just will go through the rest of your life saying, damn, I'm pretty good. I graduated from college, you know? So, again, speculate about the mechanism here. Social status is a huge factor in happiness, and we're going to talk about it a lot because it's disturbing that it's a big factor, right? Social status and social comparison, let's lump them together right now. Social status is the status you get, the attention, positive attention and status you get from your standing in a social hierarchy. So you have social status if you're wealthy and surround yourself by high status objects. Social comparison is the effect on your happiness of comparing your situation to other people. That's a little different, but it still involves hierarchy, right? So, for instance, nobody laughed last class on this cartoon, but I hope you guys will laugh in a hearty and robust way. It might not, the possibility is it might not be that funny. So I don't know if you guys have gotten around to the cartoons. They're down here somewhere. Oh, yeah. Cartoon. Have you looked at the cartoons? Oh, come on, this weekend, put it in your notes. Look at the damn cartoon. Sorry, excuse me. Alright, let's see if you guys find this one funny. This has to do with it. Get a couple chuckles, that's not so bad. There is actually research which talks about just. So if I give you a raise, we can measure the happiness you get from that. But if you find out that your coworkers also got raises, you don't. This is really sad. You don't get as much happiness from that. In fact, there's a proportion. There's like, I can't remember the research I read, but it's like for every dollar you get, for every $3 you get in a raise, that you lose the happiness from $1 if they get a raise or something like that. Okay. Question, yeah.
Didn't we have a reading semester that talked about if you were to be offered a job where you were paid $100,000 but everyone else made $150,000, where you can make $80,000 and everyone else made $50,000, which would you take?
Yeah, and because of social comparison, we actually prefer the lower in total compensation if we can have greater compensation than people around us. Absolutely. It's interesting that Gonzaga has always, I forgot to mention this in the other class, Gonzaga has periodically flirted with a pay scale that involves more merit than just years in rank. The trustees, being more entrepreneurial than the faculty, tended to want us to adopt a merit pay system where you'd actually be in competition with your colleagues every year for a little more money, and the dean would have to decide who was better each year. Oh my God, we just have always said no. And I know faculty at other schools where up to $20,000 or $30,000 of their income comes from their meeting with the dean each year, you know, and so how are you doing relative to the other people in the department? Probably a good way to build a really competitive academic department, right? But probably not a happy place, really, as far as that part goes, you know, because it's a place that's going to stimulate a lot of social comparison and, you know, a lot of invidious comparison, really. I mean, so this has a practical dimension to it in the sense that you might ask how which kind of system you would want. By the way, the other note on social status is that when you travel, you notice that people give social status differently. So when I go to Italy, if it comes up in conversation that I'm a professor, people treat me with a lot more respect. And I've been meaning to bring this to your attention, actually. Yeah, I think we should adopt the Italian custom in this country. So if you could just start. I brought my nice jacket here. I could put it on. And clothing matter. Clothing and social status matter much more in European societies, in my experience. you get looked at differently if you don't dress well. Americans are a lot more tolerant about that. We tend to make fewer social status judgments. Some theorists say we have hidden social hierarchies in this country. We like to talk about being very egalitarian, but we actually do make hierarchical judgments. So anyway, if you want to look into more research on social status, there's tons of it, and it's pretty interesting, and it helps you think about that. Okay, income's a huge one, and the big chart, you got two versions of this chart in Argyle. Where are we now, page-wise? This is... .356, .357, and you know, this is the general chart that result that people get when they measure well-being and income. I don't know if this is true for wealth. It would be interesting if somebody found research on wealth and happiness instead of income. But I think I've mentioned this before. You find that it looks something like this. So. At very low levels of income, there's a very steep increase in well-being, but it really tapers off pretty quickly, and there's a magic number here. You'll find research on this. The last thing I saw is that at about 65K, income has a much lower effect in boosting your happiness. It really things flatten out. But there is a little tail over here, right? Really, really rich people are significantly, you know, measurably and significantly happier than the rest of us. Any speculations about that? I mean, why, if money stops lifting your well-being here, why would it come in the end here? Yeah.
Maybe like a super rich in a sense of competition with their super rich friends. So when they get richer, now it's like, now it's just a sign of wealth, not to like status. No longer for their own utility as compared.
They're working on it. There is evidence that social comparison among the very wealthy works very differently. We're in a club now. I'm not in the club, but they're in the club. And notice when you're really rich, you're almost always making a downward comparison, right? So the odds are that you're making a downward social comparison to pretty much everybody in your society. And the people that you're not making a comparison to, you're in a very elite club with. So you're probably getting a boost from that, like, you know, the Billionaires Club, maybe, or something. Good. Other speculations? Yeah, I think that sounds right. In other words, don't be confused. Just because you see a function here, don't assume that the same causal effects are going on at every point in the function. There could be something special. There's very likely something special going on at this end. Notice, by the way, let me add to your explanation for your notes, really rich people have opportunities for happiness from social status that even moderately wealthy people don't have. So building the naming opportunity, you know, being able to give philanthropically, right?
Putting your name on it.
Yeah. And doing great things for people. Think about Bill and Melinda Gates. Oh my God, they've done some really incredible things. I mean, you know, so or you know, Jimmy Carter, not super wealthy himself, but his foundation has eliminated a particular kind of blindness in Africa. They're within a couple of years of doing it. You know, that's pretty amazing. You would think about your sense of accomplishment at that. So yeah, there are other point for your notice is there are other non there are other. There are other happiness makers available to the super rich that depend on their money, but really aren't the same as the kinds of happiness you're going to get when you buy your second Jaguar, right? Which I'm sure will be still quite a thrill. Okay, so let's see what else. Lottery winners. We used to think lottery winners were a good way to study the effects of income, but lottery winners' lives just get turned upside down. You know, if you've ever read a book about profiles of lottery winners, it's, you know, you wouldn't want $300 million. It's just going to mess up your life. Of course
you do.
I think there's a Woody Allen joke. I think that, yeah, one of the jokes was something like, I just want an opportunity to prove that money can buy happiness. Give me a chance.
What if you like won the lottery and like didn't change any aspects of your life? It was just kind of residual. Would that bring happiness opposed to going out and buying a Jaguar?
See, that's something you could learn interestingly from accounts of lottery winners. I haven't read that, but I don't know of a great full length account. Yeah, that's right. That would be what you'd want to look at. What if the lottery winners have stayed there, really disciplined? Yeah. Yeah.
But that still doesn't change how other people would view you. Like
right,
a lot
good
of,
point.
A lot of like lottery winners are so miserable because of how their relationships change.
Right. So everybody in the family comes forward for money.
So even if you yourself didn't change your activities, like people would still treat you differently or expect things from you.
You're reminding me of a few years ago now. They had these lottery winners up. It was just an average couple, you know, older couple. They just won like $350 million. And they're being interviewed. And is this going to change your life? Are you going to buy a big house? And the guy who just had this, you know, salt of the earth common sense shook his head and he said, oh, no, that's just a total trap. You know, a big house, you have to clean it? I mean, come on. You know, he just won $350 million. He could have, like, a staff of people to clean his mansion. But yeah, so we have intuitions like that about it. Okay. Any other points on this? Speculations? Okay, I won't go into the goal achievement gap model. It's kind of, sometimes I give it more treatment. It's basically a way of correlating three or four variables that might be related here to income. Anyway, okay, marriage is a huge one. Marriage has a robust effect on happiness, but not uniformly through a typical married couple's family life cycle. So we'll look at that data. There's a pretty big chart about that. But so we might worry about direction of causation here. Do happy people get married, or does marriage make people happy? 90% of us get married. Isn't that amazing? Maybe even that number is going to be higher, because now more couples can get married. So it intuitively it seems to make sense that if you're miserable, you're not going to do very well in the relationship market. So it makes sense that some people who don't get married because they're not happy people, and they have trouble finding someone who would really want to be with them. But but there's really good evidence that marriage does make people happier. Let's think about the mechanism. Anybody? You could remember something from Argyle or speculate on your own. Married people watch out for each other's health. So married people have better health outcomes. It's harder to go, you know, it's harder to be irresponsible about your health if there's somebody else that you're coming home to every night. Marriage provides tremendous validation. Like, there's somebody who actually wants to live with me. How exciting. Yeah, that's thinking about it. Because if you're a real traditionalist, you might say, oh, the problem with marriage today as a happiness maker is that people divorce a lot. People are actually sometimes made happier after their divorce. Because you have to imagine that when someone's getting ready to get divorced, at least one party is in a miserable state. Probably both parties are. So divorce could actually be the beginning of an uptick in your happiness. Well, marriage can make you happy even if it doesn't last forever. I mean, compare the ability of a marriage to make you happy versus three marriages. My father-in-law is a serial monogamist. Just, you know. So, I mean, it could be that you could be just as happy with multiple marriages, or even happier, maybe. I don't know. I mean, don't let your tradition... Right. So that's a good question, yeah. And remember, divorce rates flattened out in the 80s, was it? It turns out, I just read that divorce in my age group is actually doubling. Wow. What's that about? But we have a very low divorce rate, so it doubled from like 5% to 10%. Any other thoughts about why marriage might be a happiness maker and cause happiness? You got strong emotional, you put this in your notes, you get material support, companionship, those are obvious, right? So that's kind of our construct. But remember, let's take a look at the data on marriage and family life cycle. Now, this applies to the breeding class, as we might call them, people who are going to have kids, right? So you remember this chart from the article. So these are five studies plotted on the same chart showing the relationship between well-being for a married couple, marital satisfaction, by stage of family life. So the stages of family life are, this is young, the first trough here is very young kids, and the really deep trough is teenagers. So, that was you guys only a few years ago. So you were one of the biggest risk factors for your parents' happiness just a few years ago. The only time you were also a risk factor for them, but not as big a risk factor, was when you were really young. Somewhere between like not peeing in your pants and being teenagers, you were less of a burden on your parents. So, you know, people talk about whether kids make people happy. You know, if you ask me when my kids were 3 years old, if I was happy with kids, I'd say, oh my God, I'm incredibly happy. If you ask me when they were teenagers, I'd say, it's okay. I think we're going to be okay. Yeah. I love them. So it's a really hard thing to assess because kids, this might be a point for your nose, kids might go on the life satisfaction ledger, not the state happiness ledger. Right? It could be that people are made happy by their kids in a much broader sense than, yeah, I had a great time with my kids today. I mean, you do hear parents say that. It's wonderful. But you worry about your kids. They're a source of tremendous anxiety. Okay, so 5 studies seem to corroborate this idea that there's a kind of double trough in family life, and it's kind of interesting to ask. And it'd be relevant, for example, Cassidia, it'd be relevant, for example, if you are thinking about whether you want to have kids. You might be thinking, well, how would kids make me happy? And don't give up based on this research, by the way. This is not a reason to plan your life. You need to do additional reading. Like I said, I think having kids is happy in a much more generational sense. You know? But the risk is amazing. Think about the impact on happiness. This would be a good thing for you to research. The impact on happiness of losing a child. It's a very profound one, as far as I'm aware. And I don't think you come back to your baseline on it. Okay. Ethnicity has an effect on happiness. If you're a member of a discriminated or unliked group, it will be a risk factor for your happiness. Most of that hit comes from your disadvantages in job and social status. Right? There's a lot of complexity to employment. Oh, no, sorry, we're on ethnicity. Weird detail, yeah, it's always caught my attention. African-American children actually have higher self-esteem than white kids until they grow up. So how you're treated in your society really can have an effect on your happiness. I don't think it's an enormous effect. And like Argyle says, it's mostly accounted for by income, jobs, and job status. Okay, yeah, please.
Question about the marriage part. That,
sure, please.
That sentence there. Why are people in your age group delaying marriage?
Oh, I'm sorry. I just added that. I forgot to mention it in the other class. If you know, I because I have 2 sons who recently graduated from college, I've kind of been paying attention to this data. You guys are delaying marriage a lot. It's really interesting. Somebody, you might want to look this up. And I think I read something that said that women might be particularly delaying marriage because you want to get your careers going. When we get to relationship, we're going to talk about this more. Did you have a thought about that?
I was just going to ask, are there a lot of studies on that yet?
Yeah. It's a big trend. Okay. Yeah. It's a really interesting trend.
Is it because of all the divorces? Like, are we seeing our parents?
No, your age group. I'm talking people in their 20s are delaying marriage.
It could be that
you're looking at the older people and saying, well, this is kind of a dumb thing to do. You know, yeah, you could be. I mean, do we need, you could, when we get to relationships, we're going to have a lot of conversations about this, you know, because you can either ask whether the institution is the problem, or, yeah, there's a lot of ways you can go. Did you have a thought on that?
I was just
kidding. Yeah. Yeah, I would encourage you to, in this Argyle Update project, to kind of focus on things that are relevant to you like that. Some people argue there's a decline in marriage, that we might outgrow it. Some people have advocated term relationships, I mean, the marriage contract is for life. How about like 20 years? How about if we do that? We'll renew. We have another party. You know, you can imagine. So we're on the edge of that topic. But yeah.
Wasn't marriage kind of also one of the only ways that kids, like from a societal perspective? I mean, like, don't some people only get married for the...
Absolutely. And given that getting married itself confers social status, you know, all things being equal, you might think, well, what's the downside? Yeah. Good. Yeah, there's a lot more there. Now, like I said, we spend 2 or 3 days on relationships later, and we have some interesting readings about that, but more research here would be good. Okay, good. Thanks for bringing that up. So we talked about ethnicity. Employment is huge. In fact, the more I read about the effect of employment on happiness, the more puzzled I am that we don't just make sure that people have something to do. I know that's a big political discussion, and there are good reasons to not want to do that. But being unemployed really hurts people's sense of their value fundamentally. People talk like they're dying, like, I don't know if I'll survive this. You know, people really put a lot of their sense of confidence in their employment. And you know, it's another cluster effect, because if you are unemployed, you obviously experience financial disruption. You might have to move. That would disrupt some relationships, right? So there's a lot of ways that unemployment can impact not just your self-esteem, but other things that we know are happiness makers. Okay, any thoughts on that? Leisure is really a powerful one, and it's an interesting one because there's some evidence that we're not jealous of people for leisure. You know, we don't envy people for taking vacations, which is kind of interesting. Leisure effects come from the simple physical effects of engaging in a sporting activity or taking a short walk. You might have noticed there was some really robust data on just the effect on your mood of getting up and taking a walk. How many of you have been like just ever said, wow, I just gotta go take a walk? Try it this weekend, yeah. Right. I mean, it's a simple thing when you're in a funk, like you're studying and you feel overwhelmed and, oh my God, I don't have enough time to do this, am I good enough to do this, all those things that come into your mind. You know, sometimes that's actually one of the most effective things you could possibly do. It's very simple, but when you look at the physiology of it, it makes sense that we have mechanisms for understanding why a short walk around Lake Arthur might be just the trick. Sports, again, has a multifaceted effect. You're with other people. You're getting the endorphins from the physical activity. You guys have very high sports involvement. Gonzaga students in the last 20 years have just huge involvement in club sports, so you have some awareness of that. Volunteer and charity work is huge for joy, exceeded only by dancing. So my thought today for you guys is that we should find a volunteering opportunity where you can dance at the same time. That would be great. Volunteer to teach people how to dance. That would be wonderful. Okay, religion, the multivitamin of happiness, right? Huge cluster effects. Strength of religion comes from social interaction, friendships, meaningfulness, material support. Religious communities support their members in times of difficulty. If you were to be dropped in a strange city with no resources, my advice to you would be to join a church immediately. Just go and say, hey, I think I'd like to join your church. I mean, if you have a denomination, join that one. It's amazing. The good news is, if you don't have a religious commitment, you can get all of those vitamins separately. Right? It's a multivitamin of happiness, but there's independent research that each of those factors comes independently. So it's not like religion's a gatekeeper on happiness. I was curious, this time around I happened to notice that there's research that says Protestants get more happiness from their religion. I don't want to get anything started, but if you see any research on that, let's talk about it. It could be that happy people are more likely to be religious. I can't remember what Argyle said on that. Does anybody remember that one? Works through social support, increasing esteem, mindfulness, okay. And your relationship with a deity. Not all religions have a deity, a major deity, but your relationship with a deity can have happiness effects that are similar to other real relationships. You also learned in the leisure section that if you could have a relationship to a soap opera character, that also gives you some happiness. Like, you know this fictional character, like it's your friend. Like, he's your friend. Okay. Any other thoughts? Are we good? Okay, we're almost there. I didn't know. I can't make much out of the life events and activities section. I'm not sure what he's up to there. Competencies is an interesting category because it refers to attributes that you have that have a biasing effect on happiness. So for young women, it's attractiveness. For men, it's height. You might treat it's a little counterintuitive, but Argyle says you can treat health as a competence in a sense. And you might say, oh, well, I was cheated on the Bob and Mary example because I was told that Mary was happier, but she has illness. Remember that? So you might say, hey, what's going on with that? He was playing a little game with you because it's true that being healthy is a positive correlation with being happier, but it's also true that people adapt to their chronic illnesses. So there is research that Mary would be happier because her chronic illness would seem to be a deal breaker, but in fact, people adapt to their chronic illnesses. You can see how her religion might interact with that too, because it helps you understand misfortune in your life, right? Yeah.
Well, for life events and activities, what I got was that he was talking about, I kind of related it to like the ratios of positive affect to negative affect and like peak experiences.
Interesting.
So like, if you have more peak experiences, it might correlate to greater happiness.
Right. So maybe there's a bundle of experiences people have, and if you can get yourself to have more of those are
right.
Right. They might be things that things that were mentioned here that under the right circumstances don't habituate that fast. So food can habituate, but going out to dinner with people might not. Same thing with drink, you know. Sex is presumably something you're going to do with somebody else. So these are things that have a moving targets dimension to them, like we said about relationships not adapting maybe because there's always new content there. Yeah, good. Yeah, that's helpful. That's a good way to read that section. Okay, so here's what I'd like to suggest. That you consider doing the optional assignment between now and Sunday night. I'd like you to consider finding up to 3 research articles. It won't hurt your situation in the class if you don't have time to do it. But if you do, I think it's going to help us kind of make sure that Argyle's given us the latest stuff. Okay, see you guys next week.